loads of compelling stories on the radio today, from the nightmare of your house address being on a criminal's target list, reeling in the teens, and the history of the handshake. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I had to get a video doorbell. I had to fit an alarm in the house, a new back door, extra locks on the windows. I have to drive a different way to work every day.
Oh my God.
In case of kidnap.
Birds have territory. What do you think all the singing is about? It's all those males saying, I'm living here and hump off you. If you put up three nest boxes, well then, there's not going to be three birds in them. It's going to be none because they'll all be fighting with each other.
They actually used hidden cameras and showed that you are more likely to put your hand to your face and sniff if you shake hands than if you don't in a greeting.
No.
It's bonkers.
And we'll start here on the live line and a nightmare situation for caller Jan. Not being able to sleep at night, having to block up her letterbox and living in terror. All because of a mistaken address.
You came home from your work in a hospital, was a couple of weeks ago, and there is a Garda, a detective Garda, at your hall door. What did he or she want?
Absolutely. I had a detective sergeant from Coolock Guard Station at the door. Informing me that my address was out there with criminals who were targeting a prison warden, but they had my address by mistake.
Oh, my God.
And he basically just said that we need to be on guard, we need to be advised on how to stay safe. A crime prevention officer would come to the house.
Okay.
My number would be highlighted at Coolock Garda Station, and if I rang at any time of the day or night, a car would be sent straight down. And he more or less left, and I haven't heard from the guard since.
So the Garda said to you, and it was a he, wasn't he? He identified himself.
Yeah, he did.
And they said, we have become aware of a threat by an organised criminal gang, as they call them now, that your address... Not your name, but your address has been featuring on their intelligence as the address they believe they have. They're not very organised, disorganised crime gang.
Yeah.
As an address they believe they have. Is it in the same area? Not that you know, but...
So apparently the crime prevention officer came down to my house a few days later and went through the house and made a list of all the things I need to do to try and stay safe, like, you know, blocking up the letterbox, screwing it closed, buying fire extinguishers, Joe.
Wow.
That was the first thing he said to me when he rang me to make the appointment to come down. He said, I need you to immediately go out and buy two fire extinguishers. Now, can you just imagine someone telling you to do that and block up your letterbox? Because they don't know the level of threat. They don't know if it's intimidation, criminal damage, violence. A pipe bomb. They couldn't tell me.
But
they were very vague.
But they did tell you they believed the threat to be real.
Oh, 100%. They said they investigated it thoroughly and felt now that it is a real threat against the prison warden who does live close by.
Oh,
but they have my address and they can't take the information back because it's been shared amongst several different criminal gangs far and wide.
Okay, so what have you... So you're up the walls. What do you have to... What do they... The Garda advise you to do? Okay, buy two fire extinguishers immediately. Board up your letterbox.
Yes. I had to get a video doorbell. I had to fit an alarm in the house, a new back door, extra locks on the windows. I have to drive a different way to work every day.
Oh, my God.
In case of kidnap. What else did he say? I was to... If I was to be noticed, I was being followed by anyone, I was to drive straight to a Garda station or a public area, lock myself in my car and ring the guards. He gave me all of that information and left. So I'm kind of left in limbo now. It's a very unusual situation. I've never heard of it before. But I mean, needless to say, I haven't slept a night since he came to my house 2 weeks ago. My son is ill at the moment. He's fractures in his spine, so he's on the flat of his back since last October.
Good God.
So my worry, Joe, is that he's in the house all day. I work in a hospital 12 hours a day, and he's very vulnerable up there in the house. So a neighbour of mine, I obviously had to tell my neighbours because they needed to know for their safety, and they've been very, very helpful. But a neighbour of mine suggested I contact a local TD, which I did.
Yeah.
Tom Brabazon is our local TD, and he's been amazing, Joe.
Yeah, okay, well, that's
absolutely
good.
Amazing.
Well, what did he do? What did he do?
Well, he came up to my house last Friday evening at 6:30 on Good Friday, and he screwed closed my letterbox. He put a post a letterbox up on the wall for me, and he gave me a video doorbell.
Wow.
Yeah, he's been super. He also gave me two, because I have to get outside lights now to light up the place where I'm coming and going.
Mm-hmm.
So I just have to find an electrician to put them in. But as I said to the crime investigation officer, I don't have the funds
to pay for
all of these things that you're asking me to do through no fault of my own. I mean, if someone came into my house tonight and trashed it, I'd claim on my house insurance. But if someone came into my house and did that because they're targeting me when I'm innocent, he said that that's tough. You're on your own. It's up to you to make yourself safe.
Well, that's what Jan is living with. And as Joe points out, politicians are also living with security issues.
And I don't like making comparisons because when obviously the Taoiseach, according to the Sunday Independent, there's an increased level of threat against him, which is horrific, absolutely horrific, even thinking about it, as is your case. He's got extra armed security. He's also moved house. Stephen Donnelly, the Minister for Health, apparently there was some annoyance at his home, I think it's Greystones, and he got a fence, a pretty substantial fence erected, and that was paid for, I think most people would agree, rightly by the state. There was a famous case going back many years, a Minister for Justice, Sean Doherty, got and there was controversy over this, a significant wall built around his home in Coote Hall that was paid for by the state. The state come to you and say, we have received a real and viable threat against this address, address.
Everything up to a pipe bomb, Joe. That's what they told me.
And
I asked for funding or assistance or some way of paying for all these things, and I was told there's none available. And yet a neighbour of mine lives close by to a female prison warden, and she told me the story that something similar had happened to her many years ago, and immediately she was moved out of the house and high-tech CCTV was installed on her property.
This was, rightly so, but this was a prison officer.
He was actually a prison officer,
Now, on the one hand, John, I know part of your reason for contacting us today, and we want to explain this to people, is you want to say to this gang, if you have an address in Clare Hall, now I need to explain this because you've explained it at great length. First of all, we don't want anyone attacked. That's horrific.
No,
and hopefully the Gardaí, like they've done so well with crime gangs, organised crime gangs, as they call them, in the last 4 or 5 years, hopefully that continues, including in this case. But you want to say to that crime gang, if you have an address in Clare Hall...
Yeah, you've got an innocent. That's not the right address. And as I tried to find out from the crime prevention officer, I would presume they would survey the address to make sure this person lived there before they did act. And apparently that's not the case.
Explain that to me before. Explain that
to
me again.
So I was trying to figure out whether they would put surveillance, these criminals, whoever they are, on my house to see if this man lived there. And apparently that's not the case.
And Jan hasn't slept for 2 weeks.
I literally haven't, and I'm actually starting to feel sick, you know, and you can't sleep and you're in work and it just makes you sick, but it's just because you're tired. But how can you sleep with that threat? I mean, I'm going to bed every night thinking this darkness is going to come to my house and either cause criminal damage or potentially violence against me or my son.
Did the Gardaí tell you to cut down your hedge?
Oh, I had hedges surrounding my property. I've had them for 20 years. And I had to have them cut back. My neighbour very kindly did that for me because, again...
Why is that?
Because there was a blind spot when I walked out of my house to the left-hand side and they were afraid that that would be where they would come from.
My God.
And ambush me because I wouldn't be able to see them at 6 o'clock in the morning when I'm leaving to go to work.
Now, did they say if the prison officer was male or female?
It's a male. You see, I did try to establish that. They were very... Yeah. cagey about giving me information, and I appreciate that to an extent, but I have a 21-year-old in the house. Now, he's not mobile at the moment, but I was worried if they did happen to see him, they may mistake him for this guy. And they said, no, this particular prison warden is 30 years in the service, so they, and they have his picture, apparently. So they wouldn't mistake
And again, I don't want to put the heart crossways in you. It's already crossways.
No, it is.
But if we're reading stuff like, well, any of us have read the Paul Williams books or the Nicola Tallant's books or the Stephen Breen books on this whole crime thing, know how, like, the number of innocent people that have been shot dead, the number of the relatives of people who were allegedly involved in crime, they've been targeted for one reason and one reason only, because they were a blood relative.
Yeah.
And if someone saw you coming out with it, they say, that's your man's daughter.
Yeah, that's the wife or somebody, you know. And I mean, the guard said to me that it was an ongoing investigation and they'd be in touch with me. I haven't heard from them in 2 weeks. And actually, the Friday before that crime prevention guy came to my house, there was a suspicious looking car outside. I took a picture of the car, right?
Yeah.
Showed it to the guy, the guard that came to my house that Saturday. He said he'd follow up and get back to me, and I haven't heard from him since either.
And Dennis was listening to Jan, and he got in contact with this kind offer.
I just said was, I'm an electrical contractor. I put up the lights for her, whatever she needs. Likewise, I'll do it for nothing.
Fair play.
Very kind. Very kind of you. Thank you so much.
And are they motion activated, Dennis, or?
Well, I can put either or either. Yeah, either, okay. I'll pick them up if you want. No problem. We'll pick up motion.
And is there much demand for them now? Like, we're told crime is down generally. Burglary is down.
A lot of people put PIR lights up, It's just someone comes up, the light comes on, it tears them from touching your car or whatever.
And how soon? I'm not trying to put you under pressure, Dennis. But
we'll get them done this week.
Amazing.
This week, no problem.
Thank you, Dennis.
That's Dennis Walsh of Electric Works and Walkers.
Well, that's Dennis there. Then Joe spotted an issue with increased security at the house.
The other problem is that if you start putting up lights and CCTV and the new video, people say, what's she up to? Will they? I don't know.
Well, I had to tell my neighbours. The first thing I had to do was tell my neighbours, because they needed to be aware. Because these criminals are so stupid, they had the wrong address. They may get the wrong house as well if they did come.
Yeah.
So my neighbours are all on high alert and they're all aware of what's going on. So they've seen the letterbox being screwed closed on Friday evening and all of this. But I have no choice. I have to try and do all these things.
Have you explained it to your son?
I've told him a certain amount, Joe. I mean, he's going through an awful lot. He's only 21 years of age. Okay. He's literally on the flat of his back since last October. He has spinal fractures. He's had several procedures. And you see, the problem is I had to pay for these procedures privately because of COVID and the public system.
Mm.
He was literally screaming in pain. So all of the money I had, any savings I had, is gone on his procedures. And then I had to go into the public system because the money ran out. Now, lucky enough, I've got a very good consultant who's having another procedure done on the 16th of April. But immediately after he has these done, he literally is immobile because he literally he has to be flat on his back. So he's in a very, very vulnerable situation. And I'm so annoyed. Like, as a law-abiding citizen of this country, I've paid my tax all my life. I've never so much as had a parking ticket. That this was landed on my door 2 weeks ago, and the Gardaí, haven't so much picked up the phone, told me, given me any information, any follow-up on the one picture I did send them, they never came back to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just an absolute disgrace. And as I said to the crime prevention guy, if I could afford to buy a new back door and install an alarm and extra locks on windows, I would have done that by now. And he just shrugged his shoulders at me. Very nice man. But he didn't have an answer. Off he went. And you're on your own.
And retired prison officer John called Joe.
There is no doubt about that. She needs to take it really serious. And the thing about it is, her neighbour down the road, the serving prison officer, I mean, they would have been treated in the exact same fashion as she's been treated. You know, they would have gave all that information to them as well. Mm-hmm. And they have to, you know, the sad part about it is that the prison service are not a frontline service, and I've been told that on a very regular basis by everybody, when in actual fact, there couldn't be any more frontline living with this on a daily basis. And as we know, Joe, and you remember it very well, where my colleagues' homes were burned before, back in the 70s and 80s. It was a part of life for prison officers. We were told never to let our car go under half full of petrol, half full of diesel. There was no mobile phones back then. You'd let your family know, I'm leaving work now and I'd be home at a certain time. And if you didn't arrive home within 15 minutes at that time, family were worried about you. You know, so I would say that this lady needs to be very vigilant, as our, my colleagues, former colleagues, need to be as well.
Absolutely.
You know,
and as you rightly point out, John, at the heart of this is a okay, they've mistaken, they've got the wrong address, but at the heart of this is a threat to a real person.
That's correct.
Because of the job they're doing for the public.
That's correct, on behalf of the state. And I've been listening very carefully to you, Joe, over the last couple of weeks. You've been talking a lot about people in prison and one thing and another. And a lot of those decisions are well beyond the pay grade of the people that have been threatened. Mm-hmm. You know, and the men and women of the Irish Prison Service of today are very professional people. You know, they're very, very working, caring, hard-working people. And they shouldn't have to live like this, as this woman is experiencing now, through no fault of her own. And as I said earlier, this is a daily part of life for prison officers all over the country.
And John, would a prison officer, if there's a real, which there has been, as we know, and carried out, but if a prison officer told there's a real and viable threat from an organised crime gang against you and your home, would you get any help in modifying your home?
There may be some available, but I couldn't categorically state, Joe, what that is now. But I know back in the day, particularly in the early 80s, when I had to do it with my home, we were given a grant to put in, but it was paid back through your wages, to put in a security system into your home.
There should be some protocol. There should be some protocol in place for some resources to be available to people in these situations, particularly innocents. But literally, the door is closed. The Garda come, and it's their duty to inform you of the threat. And in actual fact, he said to me, I hope I don't see you again, because if I do, you will have to go into a protection service.
Program,
That would be the next step, that it would be threat to life. So, you know, they can't just walk into your house and the state just sit back and say, well, it's your problem.
Yeah. Well, the word innocence doesn't reflect very well, because everyone is innocent here.
Yeah, of course.
There is a conjecture there that there's something guilty about the prison officer. The prison prison officers today are doing their job as they always done.
Yeah, that's understood. Yeah.
That's John and Jan on the Live Line with Joe Duffy. And on today with Philip Archer-Hayes, for the stressed and difficult times we're living in, Philip had an antidote. Yes, birds. Those bird table dramas we've been binging since lockdown. Eamonn Milana was celebrating the wild birds in your garden.
Yeah, hasn't it been great? And people have been very much aware of what's happening in the world around them, very close to them, in fact. But the days of the feeders, the times for the feeders are beginning to become less and less, because once the leaves come on the trees and once the insects come on the leaves, I'm sorry to tell you, Philip, the birds much prefer the wild food than anybody's feeders. So what we should be doing now is keeping in tune with the world of birds, and indeed with the world of nature in general, because now, as your Dawn chorus showed, it's the birds are mating, they're looking for territory, and they're building nests. So we should be in supporting them to build their nests at this point. And there's lots of things people can do for this. Mm. Now, it's the very last moment to get out your nest boxes. So if you want to have blue tits or grey tits in your garden, or robins, get them out this week, because otherwise it's too late.
Before you go on to the nest boxes, just one second, because I've noticed that the birds have deserted the feeders, but I had also always thought that when you get into this nesting and fledging period, that you should remove all of that food, and that the young should be learning how to forage from natural sources and not from our help.
I don't believe everything you read in the book. No, what happens is that the birds build the nest. They have nestlings. The nestlings, when we did the studies with Derek on the blue tits, the mammy and daddy blue tit feed the babies 500 times a day. So they haven't much time for feeding themselves. So you can leave the food out. Mammy and daddy will eat it themselves if they're short, but they're not eejits. They're not going to feed it to their young. They're not going to stuff big peanuts into tiny little birds' mouths. But it gives them a boost if they haven't time to be getting stuff for themselves. So you can't really do that much harm. But one of the things that you really must do is get the nest boxes out and keep in the cat. The cat, you know, the mornings are getting longer, and if your cat has a cat flap and can go in and out between dawn and the time people get up at, and that period is getting longer and longer, the cat can do terrible depredations in the garden. Even your moggy that prefers kitty cat, it's their natural instinct to hunt and kill, and really you don't want to be doing that. So have your cat by all means, but don't let him out for that critical period in the morning, because obviously he can do depredation when nobody is looking.
And why do you
don't
suggest...
Don't be spraying things either.
Why do you suggest limiting the number of bird boxes?
Why? Well, because obviously birds have territory. What do you think all the singing is about? It's all those males saying, I'm living here and hump off you. You go away. This is my territory. It's like a job. You can't have three or four in the one area. There won't be enough food. So if you're a blue tit or your grey tit is singing and teacher, if you put up three nest boxes, well, then there's not going to be three birds in them. It's going to be none, because they'll all be fighting with each other. So because that's not their nature to be living in communities like that. Only sparrows live in communities. So put up one nest box in the right place, and don't be putting up a whole clatter of them. If one is good, 10 is better. Ain't so. One good nest box in the right place with a perch that the bird can land on before it flies in. No perch on the nest box now, but it could land on the wires and then fly into the nest box, or land on the tree and fly into the nest box. That's what you want, a properly positioned one. Not a whole heap, to be sure, because the competition, the natural competition among the birds, will stop them from competing, will stop them from using it at all.
What about
no joy at all, so don't do that.
What about different kinds of boxes with different openings for different species? I mean, I know the blue tits like the little round hole, don't they, whereas robins prefer a slightly larger square one.
Yeah, they're half door jobs. Yeah, the birds that go through holes into a nest box, obviously the size of the bird matters. So the smallest one is the blue tit, and the smallest hole will be that one. If you make it a bit bigger, your coal tit or indeed your great tit can get in, and they can compete. Whoever gets in first, it's their nest box. So if you really want blue tits, make the hole small, and it says on the nest box for which one it is. Whereas robins now will take a half door. They won't squeeze in through holes like that. And then, of course, you can become very posh altogether and put up maybe swift nesting boxes for the swifts that are going to be coming to us in May. And that's a whole scheme that has properly designed boxes. It wouldn't really be for people's houses, but they will nest in nest boxes as well too. Or if you've really won the lottery, you can put up a barn owl box, but that's Scalella Erfad. But not every bird will nest in a nest box at all. Things like blackbirds and things like thrushes, garden birds like that, they want to build their nests. So you need to have cover in your garden, some kind of a thorny tree, a thorny bush that they can actually build their nest in, and then leave food for them. Don't be spraying things. Don't be spraying and putting out blue pellets for slugs and snails. These birds have to eat. So don't be doing that. Don't be destroying whatever food you have in your garden, because people want to have nice grass and keep cutting it. Leave a bit of food for the birds. Otherwise, it won't work.
Anna Nilauna with Philip Archer Hayes in the morning. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, the return of Reeling in the Years. This time it's the teens, 2010 to 2019. And John O'Regan leads the team that curate our memories of the past few decades. And he was Ryan's guest in the morning.
Before we talk about this decade, let me just say that as soon as Donald Trump got elected and then COVID came in again, people always use now Reeling in the Years as an expression to say they'll need one for every week, let alone every year. Pressure to put this decade together must have been intense.
There's a little bit, yes. We'll find out on Sunday when it starts going out, and we'll see what people make to it. But I mean, what we tried to do with the program is make pretty much the same type of program that we've made all the way along. And you're kind of aiming for that blend of Irish and foreign and upbeat, downbeat music, slow and fast, and a blend of news and current affairs and music and sport.
Yeah.
So that's what we've tried to do, and we'll find out if people like it or not.
Of course they will. Very shortly. But because we could see the ad running over the weekend, and we saw in that short, it must have been, 30 seconds to a minute or whatever, we saw the Anglo-Irish Bank sign, we saw the Queen's visit, the Queen's with Obama's visit, with Theresa Mannion's iconic report that time. So let's go consecutively and begin with 2010. And tell us a little bit about what
can
expect.
Start the series in 2010 on Sunday coming. It's the year of the ash cloud, if you remember. There's a volcano in Iceland, and it brought travel chaos across northern Europe. lots of new things coming into Ireland and abroad. It's the time Google Street View came to Ireland. It's the, the beginning, it's the launch of the iPad. The Aviva Stadium was opened on Lansdowne Road, and you had the Chilean miners rescue, if you remember that. The 33 miners trapped underground. They were rescued after, I think, 69 days. The huge earthquake in Haiti, and there was a big freeze. It's also the year, I suppose, that the main story of that year is the bailout. It's a rapidly deepening economic crisis. There's a worldwide global crash. 2 years earlier, countries like Greece in a lot of trouble, specifically in Ireland's case. It's a banking and property crash. You've got spiralling debt. You've got fears of international contagion across the Eurozone. And by late 2010, Ireland is effectively starting to run out of time and money. We've got two voices for you to listen to.
I'm getting an ulcer.
Well, it's a short clip. It's a short clip. When people talk about nostalgia, I'm not sure how happy people would be on Sunday night to look back at this kind of thing. But Ollie Wren is the first voice you hear. He's the EU Commissioner for Monetary Affairs, and he's followed by Taoiseach Brian Cowan.
It is essential now to stop the financial bushfire concerning Ireland before it becomes a European-wide forest fire.
I can confirm that the government has today decided that Ireland apply for financial assistance to the European Union.
And so it began.
So it began, yeah. 67.5 billion euro was the bailout. The impact of that crash, of course, is right through the series of reeling. It's right through the decade.
Yeah.
You've got everything from ghost estates. You've got unemployment at around 15%. Yeah. You've got immigration returning as a feature of Irish life.
And every year has its highlights. But John spoke about the many events of 2011.
Well, if we step into 2011, it's full of memorable events. It's a bit like 2016 that you mentioned. It has everything abroad. You've got the Arab Spring, if you remember. It started a street protest in Tunisia, spreads right across so many countries. It becomes open revolution, topples regimes, Libya, Egypt, so many countries across the Arab world. It's 2011 is also the year of the tsunami in Japan, the Fukushima nuclear disaster. In Ireland, you had a general election, huge losses for Fianna Fáil, the Green Party. Fine Gael and Labour coming to power. It's the year of a presidential election and Michael D. Higgins winning the first of his two terms. But in the many, many events of 2011, and certainly as a year as we were editing it, I know that there are many events that we have left out of 2011. Well, there's one week in May, it's particularly memorable, where Ireland's playing host to two visits by international heads of state. You've got Britain's Queen Elizabeth and American President Barack Obama. For the Queen, it's the first visit by a British monarch to the Republic. You've got a few voices to listen to here. The first voice is President McAleese at Dublin Castle at the state banquet for Queen Elizabeth on Wednesday, the 18th of May, 2011.
Okay.
This visit is a culmination of the success of the peace process. It is an acknowledgement that while we, none of us, can change the past, we have chosen to change the future.
With the benefit of historical hindsight, we can all see things which we would wish had been done differently, or not at all.
Remember that whatever hardships the winter may bring, springtime's always just around the corner. And if they keep on arguing with you, just respond with a simple creed. It's fait à ling. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
I mean, that is a tale of three different speeches. I remember them. I remember well because I was very fortunate to meet both the players that time, the Queen.
On a Wednesday morning at around 9 o'clock.
God, it was cold and sunny, and I was walking through the city going, God, my granddad saw me now heading to shake the hand of the Queen of England.
Well, the interesting one there is when you hear the Queen saying, Uachtaránach sa Chairde, which, you know, struck an awful lot of people and struck me at the time watching it as it was going out. But then I learned that it's pretty much standard procedure for a British state visit that the Queen always starts a speech in the native language. So she goes to France. The first words are in French.
Okay.
We're not. However, what you have to say, the reason why it struck so many of us, it's got particular significance and resonance in Ireland because what Britain obviously did to suppress the language across the centuries. So the impact of those words is far greater than it would be in other places. And you also have to think of, you know, symbolic moments like the Queen placing a wreath at the Garden of Remembrance to pay respect to the people who died fighting for Irish freedom.
Yeah.
So there's so many moments across those visits. The Queen was here for 4 days. President Obama was here for about 12 hours.
He was. I was backstage at the Obama speech in College Green, and we all got to meet made him say hello, sure, whatever. Yeah. But as I was passing by, I had to do something on the stage briefly. I saw the auto cue, which is the teleprompter, as they say in America, and for President Obama's speech. And they had phoneticized the Taoiseach as Taoiseach, T-E-A-S-H-O-O-K. And I said to the guy, because he was very Secret Service, kind of uptight looking fella, I said, look, it's not my business. I said, but if you change shook to shock, you could do yourself a favour.
Is there nothing he can't do? Then John spoke about Katie Taylor's success in the boxing ring.
There are many outstanding sporting moments across the decade. This is a terrific moment. These are what you have here are the sounds from the 9th of August 2012. You're in the XL Arena at the London Olympics. You've got Wicklow boxer Katie Taylor fighting in the lightweight final. She's fighting Sofia Uchigaba, and the commentary is by the late Jimmy McGee.
Every town and village in Ireland seems to be represented here. And Taylor goes after Uchigaba again.
The winner by a score of 10 points to 8 and the Olympic champion.
Katie Taylor is the champion of the Olympic Games. Fabulous, Katie.
Beautiful. And let me ask you about the music choices, because ever since I started watching Reeling in the Ears, like everyone else, the majesty of the connection with the music and the footage we're looking at it can't be understated. Where are we going in this decade between the teens?
Well, the teens, I suppose you call them the difficult years, Ron. The target's always with Reeling in the Ears. You'd want to blend that Irish and foreign. You want to blend fast and slow. You always want to foreground the Irish soundtracks, and you always want to bring in as many pop and chart hits as you can. I've picked a couple of tracks here to give you an inkling of the process. Like, obviously with COVID, it's quite similar, I suppose, to a lot of people who are like us, who were lucky to have work at this time. But the way we'd work the show is we can't do it the way we used to. So we have two very talented researchers, Owen Cody and Ronan Murphy, and we'd go through lists of footage, and we'd work out what we can afford and the licenses for copyright. And, you know, they would compile footage onto computer drives, and I'd take it home, and I'd end up, I can give you an example, the one that sticks in my mind, you know, there kind of midnight or 1 o'clock kitchen table, and you've got the computer drives. We're talking about 2012 there, and you're blasting through it and you're looking at all the footage, and I write everything out in A4 hardback copies. I've got about 15, maybe more of them now. Everything I write out longhand, because it helps me to work it all out.
Wow.
So in 2012, if you think of 2012, you've got the opening of the Titanic Centre, Belfast, looking at that footage. Would be good to have a Northern Ireland story, because we're always doing the troubles. No, look, hang on, there's a Costa Concordia sinking, if you remember that big tanker. And then you're looking at the Loyalist flags, because Tommy Gorman's got a really good piece there from Belfast City Council. Do you remember the Loyalist flags protest?
Yeah, yes.
And Richard Haas, oh no, that was 2013. And there's a Sinn Féin councillor saying some Loyalists are behaving like it's 2012, but that's a century ago. Would that connect to the Titanic? Don't know. And so I'm looking at Taylor Swift, this is somebody I used to know. Do you remember somebody I used to know?
Taylor Swift.
And then you're thinking, well, Taylor Swift, hang on, We Are Never Getting Back Together. And you've got, oh, look, there's Lance Armstrong admitting to doping. And Ronan's told me Pat McQuaid's Irish guy's in charge. Would that work? And then you look at the Loyalist flag protest. You've got Martin McGuinness shaking hands. You've got, oh, Sean Quinn in the court case.
Oh, my God, my head is melted.
But so what's going to work? And you can see it in a few weeks. Nathan Nugent, the editor, has cut it together. You see, and viewers can decide if it works or not. All those things. Mahon Tribunal, Bertie Ahern. You go talk to your friends, talk to my friends, talk to me. But we are never, ever, ever getting back together, like ever.
John O'Regan from Reeling in the Years on the Ryan Tubridy Show. And on Morning Ireland, remembering internationally renowned soprano and music teacher Dr. Veronica Dunn, who died yesterday at the age of 93.
The one wonderfully talented Veronica Dunn, soprano, educator, mentor, friend. Just some of the many words used to describe the world-renowned opera singer who has died at the age of 93. Known to her friends as Ronnie, she made her debut in 1948 in the role of Michaela in Carmen. She toured the world's finest opera houses in the 60-plus years since. We are joined now by soprano and friend Celine Byrne. Celine, thank you so much for joining us, and our sympathies to you, all her friends and family this morning. And she was your friend and you were her student, but you became friends.
Yeah, I think anybody that knows Ronnie, you can't just meet her and walk away. When you meet her, she's becomes part and parcel of your life. You kind of get engrossed in her and she in you. And that's just the way she is.
And she was a very generous person. I've seen that written a lot about her in the hours since her death was announced. So generous with her time, with her expertise. She really invested in people that she met.
Yeah, she was generous with it to a fault, you know. She would give anybody the last euro out of her pocket, and she was very generous to people with her teaching. And you know, even when I went to her, you know, she'd always say to me, now, you know, I'd go to pay her and she goes, now, no, don't be paying me. You need that money now to buy your groceries this week. And I'm like, Ronnie, it's fine. You know, I have to pay you. You know, it's your job. And she was like, no. And then she had loads of people, you know, coming through that lived with her for a while. Even she invited them. She said, like, don't be coming up and down the country now. You stay with me, love you, and I'll look after you. And I know a lot of people lived with her, like Anthony Kearns and everything like that. And she was just very, very generous with her time and with her spirit and with her knowledge. It wasn't just a case where you'd walk in and meet Ronnie, have your lesson and go home. It was never like that. She'd always ring you and she'd ring me and she'd say, well, lovey, how are you getting on today? And let's do 5 hours tomorrow. I'd be like, Ronnie, you joke? And she goes, no, we need to do 5 hours tomorrow. And she'd cancel all her lessons to work with you solidly for 5 hours. And she's just a fantastic woman and she'd be greatly missed by a lot of people.
What impact did she have on your career then, Celine?
I went to Ronnie after doing my undergraduate in the DIT, the College, the Conservatory of Music and Drama. And then I went to the Academy to do my master's. And it was, Ronnie was the reason I went to the Academy. I met her the summer before and I had no plans to go on and do a master's. And I was pregnant with my third child. And I met her during the summer in Wexford at this inaugural young artist programme, which they only had one at the time. And I met her and we were doing a bit of singing and she goes, you have to come to me, lovey. And I said, okay, Ronnie, but you know, I'm pregnant. She goes, yeah, I can see that. Now you better tell your husband to put away, to start wearing his wellies. And she says, but we're going to work together and, you know, you're going to work hard and we're going to do it. And I said, oh, Ronnie, I love music. And she goes, yeah, you come to me. And I did 2 years master's with her and continued my studies with her up to, like, I mean, I went to her, I saw her there last year. I popped over to see her on my way home and I left her a little something on her doorstep. And she was like, come on in, lovey. Come on in and I'll give you a few lily lallies, a few lessons. And I said, we can't because of the coronavirus, you know. And I'm kind of sad now that I didn't go in and spend more time with her.
I know.
I spoke a lot on the phone. But she did so much for my career. She gave me the confidence that I needed because I didn't really have much confidence when I was doing my undergraduate. So I went going to her to do my master's. She just pushed me out there and she goes, put your 2 feet on the ground and sing and you can do it. And she gave me so much confidence and refined my training. She was just amazing.
She really was. You were privileged to have known her. And thank you so much, Celine,
yes, I was.
For joining us to pay tribute to your friend, Veronica Ronnie Dunn.
From Morning Ireland. Now, about 14,000 women go through the trauma of miscarriage every year in Ireland. In the morning, Philip Badger-Hayes asked Sheila Shoga why she looked at this issue in a new documentary for TG Cahir.
Because it happened to me. I was one of those women, and I found the silence deafening when it happened. And when I opened up publicly, I felt this sense of community and connection, that I wasn't alone. And I realized that, you know, it's important that we talk about real issues that affect a lot of people. And you know what? You've just quoted that figure there. And we've spoken to experts, and I mean, world experts on the topic, who have said that those figures are far below what they probably are in reality, because so many women miscarry in their own homes and never tell anyone. So they don't go to their doctor and report they've had a miscarriage. So they're not included in those overall figures. So, but even when you hear it like that, you realize, yeah, why are we not talking about this? And we're not talking about this because historically we haven't really spoken about, you know, women's issues, speaking about, you know, our reproductive system and all that goes with it. And certainly miscarriage is one of those things that, you know, historically was not spoken about. You just got on with it and it happened, but you just kind of brushed it under the carpet and on you went with your life. And in the documentary, we speak to people, you know, across all ages who have their own unique perspective of it. It's so personal to everyone. It impacts every woman and every couple differently. It's not a one size fits all. So it was a huge undertaking. But I think the fact that this is the first time on Irish TV, this is 2021, this is the first time that the topic of miscarriage has ever been covered solely in a documentary style TV programme, which I think speaks absolute volumes about where we're at.
It's almost as if the entire system is designed to keep, you know, drawing a veil across this. That standard piece of advice, don't talk about the pregnancy for the first 3 months, wait until a 12-week scan. Is there any medical reason nowadays for not talking about your pregnancy when you have 7 and 8 week scans? Is this entirely a kind of a cultural thing that we do to just avoid having to talk about miscarriages, do you think?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, from what I've learned from speaking to experts is that, you know, long ago, yeah, the 12 weeks or the 3 months was because really until then, you may not have even realized that you were pregnant, because, you know, in a time before scans and the blood tests that are now readily available to people. Now, not everybody does it, but you can if you want. Now, obviously, it requires people having to spend money on going in for early scans and that kind of thing. So I do appreciate that it's not maybe an option for everybody. But what they have said now is, you know, if you get to your perhaps your 7 or 8 week early scan, and, you know, your doctor, your gynecologist, whatever it is, sees what they need to see, that's almost the same as getting to the 12-week mark. But we still hang on. I suppose we're products of our upbringing, of conditioned thought, and these things carry on and through the generations that we don't talk about it. I'm a talker. I'm really open as a person. So I find it hard to stay silent about things and keep things secret. You know, you'll kind of, I wear my heart in my sleeve. It's just the personality type that I am. So I tend to be quite open anyway. And it's not everybody's cup of tea, and I appreciate that it's not. And some people like to keep it private, and that's their prerogative, and everybody's entitled to do what suits them personally. But what I've learned collectively through working on this documentary is that the damage of silence, it is real. It's not just airy fairy or I'm making it up. I've felt it, I've experienced it from talking to too many people to know that it isn't helping anyone.
Sheila Shoiga from Today with Philip Archer-Hayes. And in the afternoon, Catherine Thomas was talking to Ray Byrne about his plans to row from America to Ireland.
I live in Brooklyn at the moment. So I'm from Kilmac in County Waterford originally. But I was actually born in the States. Mom and dad eloped to America at a very young age, and just coincidentally happened to have me around that time here.
Okay.
So, and then we came back. Dad was deported when we were about 3, ended up all coming back to Ireland, kind of a classic Irish story, and then moved back to, my mom is from Kilmac in Waterford. So we came back to the village and they took over my grandfather's bar on Main Street, which was Keating's Pub. And then I grew up there. So playing sports, like classic little village in Ireland growing up.
Okay, and amazing, then when you moved back childhood. To the States, did you always kind of have a hankering to go back because you knew that you had a link there, or why New York, or were you just like loads of your friends who were heading back?
Yeah, I first went back to San Francisco just because it was where I was born, and I just kind of wanted to go back and see what that was. But New York was. There was my cousin was in kind of the same situation as I was. He had been born over here and then grew up at home in Kilmack, and he had moved back to New York. Our uncle lived in Philly, and so I came over to visit Stevie after college at home, and there was no great plan. I've been here 20 years.
Okay. You
know? New York always felt like home, though. People walk really fast, and I always just kind of fell into that slipstream.
Okay, and it is. It's an amazing city. I mean, I've visited many times, and I've always kind of been envious of people who get to live a part of their life there. It's a tough city, though. I mean, it is very much, from my friends who live over there, it is a city, and it's like it does exactly what it says on the tin. You work hard and you play hard. It is an intense place to be, and I know that you had a difficult time and that you had a bit of a battle on your hands with alcohol, with the drink.
Yeah, for sure. It's been a battle since I was pretty young, I suppose, kind of in that like 16 to 18 year old range, kind of starting to drink. And then, I mean, to put it simply, it's just it kind of starts as you being wild and free, and then it just turns into it being really sad. And the only one that doesn't notice it is you, you know. So over the course of kind of going to college, getting into some kind of brushes with the law at home, and then staying out for days on end, drinking. And like you think you're a bit of a hero back then doing it, but you don't really kind of grasp the consequences down the line a little bit. And then drugs to keep the whole thing going, always like kind of searching for oblivion and the void, but fighting it every step of the way. And that's a kind of a strange oxymoron, but you're trying to stay up for days on end, but really you're just looking kind of for this nothingness. And that continued on for me to New York. And I mean, I'm functioning all the time as well. And I'm working in the bar business, which is, you know, everyone's kind of drinking all the time. And like you said, New York is just a hard party, hard work kind of place. And you're going to find lots of people who are like that here.
So let's get to your next challenge. And I feel like I could talk to you all day, but I'm conscious that we've got limited time. So I want to talk about this, because this is pretty seismic and pretty special. So what are you off to do?
So in about 6 weeks, I leave New York to row a small boat home to Ireland.
Okay, so that didn't happen over a pint in a pub with a couple of mates. How did this happen for you? Like, where did the idea come from?
The idea kind of for me, again, it's like everything always gets a little bit more extreme. And it works for a lot of things. So from the like Marathon des Sables, which you're running in the desert, and I thought the next level up would just take away the safety nets, like no race organizers, something where you can literally, it's going out into the void again, you know, with Ireland being the goal at the end. And I read adventure things and different type of expedition stuff and explorers, and I had seen ocean rowing mentioned. And I was like, wouldn't it be amazing to just row a little boat from New York and all the kind of
Is this with no rowing, boating experience?
Zero.
Okay. Okay. So it's you and how many others? This is like a proper tiny rowing boat. You don't have like trailing boats behind you, in front of you.
No.
This is you guys on your own.
Yeah. So there's three of us all together.
Okay. Okay. And describe the boat to me.
The boat is about 25 foot long.
Right.
It has two rowing positions. You're sitting right on the water like a rowing boat, but it also has a covered stern. So there's about 6 to 7 feet at the end where essentially it's a cabin. Now, you can't even kneel up in the cabin, but that's where we'll sleep and be shielded from the elements. And it also creates the ability to self-right. So our little boat is going to get tossed in some big, big waves in the North Atlantic. So potentially big storms. There's big, big swell out there.
Ray Byrne with Catherine Thomas in the afternoon. And in the morning, the history of the handshake. Ella Al-Shamahi has written a book on this gripping issue, and she was talking to Philip Boucher-Hayes.
You're in London, I'm in Dublin, but if you were here in studio with me, would you have shaken my hand this morning, knowing what we know now?
No. So I would not shake your hand, but I would expect that in a year's time, definitely in 2 years' time, we would be shaking hands and I would be very happy about it.
So you don't think that it's going to be consigned to the dustbin of history then?
No, and it would kind of be the first time if that was the case, because actually history teaches us that every single time there has been a pandemic or an epidemic that has killed the handshake off, it's only ever temporary. If you look at the Spanish flu, that killed the handshake in a lot of parts of the world. In fact, in Prescott, Arizona, they actually made the handshake illegal. At the end of the 1700s, an Irish-American writer, Matthew Carey, describes how people would basically, kind of shun each other when it came to the handshake. They were literally terrified of each other's hands because of a yellow fever epidemic. And guess what? In both of those cases, the handshake came back. And there's loads of other examples as well like that. Mm. So I think, I think the handshake will come back.
Let's talk about how long it's been with us, because I always thought that that business, that suggestion that it was initially a way of showing that you didn't have a weapon in your hand, was a little bit bogus. Your book shows that it goes back a lot further than that.
Yeah, so I completely agree with you on the bogus thing. It's actually one of the reasons I wrote this book, because when the pandemic started, this was what was constantly regurgitated. And I just thought, well, hold on a second. I work in a lot of hostile territories. That surely just provides access, as opposed to demonstrating that you don't have a weapon. And in fact, one US president was actually killed by an assassin coming in pretending to shake their hands. I argue in the book that the handshake is at least 7 million years old. I argue this partly on the basis of chimps shaking hands. So chimps and bonobos shake hands. Sometimes they even shake feet, which is just beyond me in terms of adorableness. can you imagine shaking them? It's too much.
I'm sure bonobos would do it a lot more elegantly than us. The idea of humans to sit down on the ground and put their feet in the air doesn't really look great or particularly dignified.
Well, it's interesting you say it's probably more elegant than us, because Dr. Kat Hobater, who's a primatologist, actually did a whole pile of research on what the handshake in kind of chimps and bonobos mean. And she has this great footage of these two chimps kind of going at each other in this fight, similar to the way we would kind of go at each other in a fight, and then sheepishly going up to each other to shake hands to say, let's make up. So it's actually really, really similar culturally to our handshake. And you've got to think, well, if chimps are shaking hands, and if we're shaking hands, and if bonobos are shaking hands, we're all each other's closest living relatives. It makes sense that our common ancestor who lived 7 million years ago.
Well, you're making a bit of a leap here, because we can observe chimps and bonobos today, but how do we know that 7 million years ago this was going on?
Well, so usually if two species who are related by descent, they're very closely related, like we are to the chimps and the bonobos, do something, you kind of assume that it's by descent. Obviously, you can't 100% be sure of it, because sometimes it's just independent evolution. But here's the interesting thing. We actually use handshakes to communicate with each other chemically. And this is shocking for most of us, because most of us like to think that as humans, we don't need to communicate with each other chemically, that we're not animals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, we are animals. We do communicate with each other chemically. There's all these fantastic experiments where they put cotton gauze under people's armpits. They got them to watch films that were happy or sad, and they gave that gauze to a different bunch of people, and they accurately reflected those emotions on their faces. And they're able to show that the handshake, when you actually shake somebody's hands, you actually do transfer chemical signals. Not just that.
So hang on, socially, are we creating an opportunity for us to smell somebody when we shake their hand?
Yes, this is it. And this is what's shocking to us because it's unconscious, clearly. And they actually used hidden cameras and showed that you are more likely, significantly more likely, to put your hand to your face and sniff if you shake hands than if you don't in a greeting.
No.
It's bonkers. Yes. This is, there's all this
no.
stuff. No. This is the point. We like to think that we're not animals, but we are just animals. It's just that we're also able to write and, you know, sing and do poetry. But actually there's all this, all the normal communication methods that, you know, you expect the animals in the plains of Africa to use. We still use that stuff. It's just,
we,
you know,
sniff our hands after shaking somebody else's hand,
yes,
however
this
unconsciously.
Yes, this is good research Lord. From the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and it's absolutely it is really fascinating. Chemical signals are just fascinating. Yeah.
And surely the handshake isn't the only greeting in town.
So there are some that are still in existence. So in, for example, Gulf Arab states, they shake hands and then they rub the noses at the same time, which, you know, is wonderful. And also, if you think about chemical signals, that's quite literally on the nose. You're literally just sniffing the other person. You're not even, you know, needing the handshake, so to speak. There's the Liberian finger snap, which is where you shake hands in Liberia. And then at the end, you basically do a finger snap. You literally snap your fingers, and the louder the snap, the better. And then there are some recently extinct ones.
So sorry, hang on a second. In Liberia, is that the sort of the equivalent of the hand pump and metacarpal crushing handshake is a really loud at the end of it?
Yeah. The more you like someone, apparently, the louder the snap. It's not just Liberia, actually. It's quite a few countries in Africa. And then there's some which are, you know, fantastic and very recently extinct, like the penis shake, the penis handshake, which is, you know, fascinating.
Half term holiday. I think we should turn down the radios in certain houses. There's going to be a bit of listener discretion advised for this next 30 seconds. Go ahead, Ella.
No, that's it. It was practiced by one tribe in Australia, and it's kind of just got extinct in the last 100 years.
Okay, and bearing in mind our just after 11:30 time of the day, describe how they would do this.
Well, so it was basically you would offer it to the neighbor, to whichever village you turned up at, and if the men of that village refused to shake it, it was akin to a declaration of war. It was really fascinating. And so it would be offered to the other members of that tribe in the hope that one of them would shake it because they would back you up. And if you think about us being animals, it's not weird, you know.
Well, it's certainly an expression of trust offering it to somebody else. But did it mean that women in these tribes weren't able to exchange greetings?
No, I mean, well, this is the interesting thing because, of course, the anthropologists are often men, especially back then. And so really, we have no idea what was done by the women, but certainly that wasn't one that was practiced intersex, like between sexes, should we say. But we don't really know a lot of the time what the female greetings were, if they were just practiced amongst women. Mm. But certainly that one wasn't one that was practiced with women. But there's a lot like this. There's the bum salutation, that was practiced all over the world. From.
I think I'm going to need to apologise at the end of this.
We'll stop there. But the point is, I had a lot of fun writing the book, partly because of so much science, There was all this anthropology, all these recently extinct greetings that are just absolutely fascinating.
Ella Al-Shamahi on Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.